Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. So, just to sum up the Noble Eightfold Path, this is that middle way. Just go up just a tiny bit. Whoop. Okay, summing up the Eightfold Path. This is that middle way awakened to by the Buddha, which gives rise to vision, to knowledge, which leads to peace, direct knowledge to awakening to Nibbana. Enter upon this path, you make an end of suffering. So, Nibbana. When you know and see thus, the mind is no longer pulled out into the world of the five senses, is liberated from the wanting outflow. It no longer flows out just to be, it is liberated from the being outflow. And it no longer leaks out because of delusion. It is liberated from the delusion outflow. And when liberation occurs, the knowledge of liberation invariably follows. You understand, rebirth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more rebirth or reappearance in any state of existence. Now, I included this little passage because so many people quote this to say there is an unborn, an unformed, an un, whatever, I don't know, an unconditioned. But it depends upon your translation. If you translate it strictly according to the Pali grammar, the aim, it doesn't mean the opposite in this case, it means the absence. There is the absence of birth, absence of being, absence of creation, absence of will. If there was not, there would be no way out of birth, being, creating, and willing. And I put this little commentary in here. And I include this well-quoted but ill-understood passage from one of the outer regions of the suttas. And I like that idea because the main body of teachings of suttas are the Nikayas, the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sanyutta, the Anguttara, and this is in the Kudaka, it's called miscellaneous section. You know, the bits and pieces. And in there you have one of those, you have things like the Dhammapada, there you also have Terigata, there you have this is the Udana. And so it is very sort of, it's in there, but it's not part of the main body. Like I call it the outer regions of the suttas. If it was so important, why do you not see it in the main Nikayas? I've replaced it with a more accurate translation. The prefix A, before the Pali past participle, Jata Bhuta Kata Sankata, does not mean a state of existence where there is no birth, being, creating, or willing. Just like Amatang does not mean a permanent state of existence of ones who are deathless or the undead, i.e. zombies. Sometimes they call it the deathless, the undead, and that's called zombies. Am I right in that? I don't know because I've never seen zombie movies. But I do know that once in this retreat center, there was a retreat when people would do their walking meditation all together. And they were all dressed in white. And they were walking slowly, moving gently. And it just so happened a visitor with their children came to Bodhinyana Monastery for lunch. I wasn't teaching that retreat, I was over there looking after everybody. And the children, their parents asked, is it okay if we just go and have a look at Jhana Grove Meditation Center? Just a look, we'll be quiet, we won't disturb anybody. He said, yes, fine. So they came in and had a look. And when they went back, they came back to see me. And the children were terrified. They said, Ajahn, zombies in your retreat center. Lifting, lifting, walking. And so for that day, we call that slow walking meditation, zombie meditation. Just keep a sense of humour. Sometimes I walk even slower than that, but because we don't do it all together, it doesn't look like a bunch of zombies come to attack the kids. Anyway, but in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, that book which I wrote, I mention some examples of the problems that language makes for us over what I call nothing words. Now, words which try and describe absence of things, nothing, emptiness, void, there's nothing. In particular, this is from Alice in Wonderland, the White King asked Alice whether she could see either of his messengers on the road. I see nobody on the road, said Alice. I only wish I had such eyes, the king replied in a fretful tone. To be able to see nobody, and at that distance too. Why, it's as much as I can do to see real people by this light. Then after a messenger did arrive, the king asked him, who did you pass on the road? Nobody, said the messenger. Quite right, said the king. This young lady saw him too. So, of course, nobody walks slower than you. I do my best, the messenger said in a sullen tone. I'm sure nobody walks much faster than I do. He can't do that, said the king, or else he'd have been here first. Just having fun with like making nobody into a person instead of the absence. So an author like Lewis Carroll was brilliant in things like that. So, your deliverance is unshakable. This is your last life. Now there'll be no renewal of existence. For this is a supreme noble wisdom, namely the knowledge of the destruction of all suffering. So this holy life does not have gain, honour and fame for its main purpose, or the attainment of virtue for its main purpose, or the attainment of jhana as its main purpose, nor insight for its main purpose. The main purpose of the holy life is this unshakable deliverance of mind, full awakening. That is the goal. This goal is essence and its culmination. And it may be that you will think that teacher's instructions have ceased once he was about to pass away. Now we have no teachers. It should not be seen like this, for what I have taught and explained to you as Dhamma and discipline will, at my passing, be your teacher. So the Buddha left the Dhamma, the training, that to be your teacher. You should live as islands unto yourselves. And because of that, that somebody mentioned that soon Britain will become Buddhist. You know why? Because after Brexit, it will be an island unto itself. Okay. Where's a contemporary joke? You can't have heard that before unless it was 2 days ago. You should live as islands unto yourselves, being your own refuge with no one else as your refuge, with the Dharma as your island, with the Dharma as your refuge. For these reasons, those matters that I have discovered and proclaimed should be thoroughly learned by you, practiced, developed and cultivated, so that this holy life may endure for a long time, that it may be for the benefit and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit of happiness of devas and humans. So sometimes people ask, well, you get enlightened. Great for you. What about everyone else? It's one person. One single individual became enlightened 2,500 years ago under the Bodhi tree. Enlightened, taught, and then disappeared. one person, 2,500 years later, still is having an enormous influence. One Buddha's teachings are for a long time. So we don't need too many Buddhas. Once every 2,500 years, 5,000 years. What we need is people to follow those teachings, become arahats, and leave. And on the subject of leaves, this is one of the powerful teachings. Which do you think are greater? The few leaves that I hold in my hand, said the Buddha, or all the leaves in the forest, asked the Buddha. The leaves in the forest, came the obvious answer. Likewise, the things that I know but have not taught to you are many, like the leaves in the forest. Wow, he knew more than he taught. Is there some secret teachings? Is there some things which people weren't wise enough to understand? Because the Buddha admitted he didn't teach everything he knew. But the next sentence. Whereas the things that I have taught you are few, like the leaves in my hand, the reason that I have not taught you these things is because they are irrelevant to the holy life and do not lead to awakening. So in other words, the things he didn't teach are just irrelevant. That's why he didn't teach them. So, now going on to the main course. That was just the appetizer. We have the gradual training. And the reason I say this is because when I was talking about the Eightfold Path, this is like a parallel to the Eightfold Path. But doesn't replace it, in contradiction to it. It's just looking at it from another angle. So the gradual training. A Buddha appears in the world, accomplished, fully awakened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, well liberated, knower of the world, incomparable teacher of those who can be taught, teacher of gods and humans, the awakened one, the master. Iti piso bhagava allahang samma sambuddho vija charana sampanno sukato loka vidu anuttaro purista dhamma sarati satta deva manusana buddha bhagava. That's what we chant. Used to chant it at 6 o'clock in the evening, but now it's supposed to be 6:50 in the evening. 7 o'clock. Sometimes. It's more important to know what the words mean than the time when they're chanted. Because sometimes people say, well, we chant all this thing, what does it really mean? And there you start to see it. Those chants have a lot of meaning. Accomplished arahant, worthy, fully awakened, sammasambuddho, perfect in true knowledge and conduct. Not just knowledge, but in conduct. That's why if you see a monk or a nun, a teacher, check them out. Don't just believe in them. Make sure their conduct is according to their what they teach. Well liberated, know of worlds. You know what know of worlds means? It means like the three worlds. They have the karma loka, the rupa loka, and the arupa loka. And the karma loka is the world of the five senses. And the rupa loka is the world of jhana. And the arupa of the immaterial attainments. And when you feel like the three worlds, the tiloka, this is actually what the Buddha was referring to. They're almost other worlds, separate. And it is true, in those worlds, if a person does do lots of jhanas or dies having done lots of jhanas, then they get reborn in that realm, the rupa loka. They can stay there for eons. And people sometimes ask, just the end of this universe. Big bang, and eventually the universe will peter out. The suns will lose all their energy. They will burn out. And so what will happen where would everyone go? And of course, they say that this is just a universe, it's the other world. People, for the most part, get reborn in the jhana realms. They've got no choice. That's where they go. So the world of the mind is, huge. It's not just a world of stuff.
Ajahn,
yeah.
We need to be taken as 31 planes of existence.
Yeah. Yes, 31 planes of existence. But some of those planes, they're those heavenly realms and the rupa lokas. Those rupa lokas, the jhana realms, they're based on first, second, third, fourth jhanas, and then the arupas afterwards. And incomparable teacher of those who can be taught, Anuttara Purusa Dhamma Sarati. And the nice reassuring word there, if ever you become a teacher of anything, even the Buddha couldn't teach some people. But of those who could be taught, he was the best teacher. So just because you try and teach your kids and they won't listen, remember, even a Buddha could not teach some people. Maybe that Ajahn Chah couldn't teach some people. So, you know, when, you know, it's just, I take a lot of solace in that. When people leave and go somewhere else, or the monks disrobe, or they do something else, I always remember that even the Buddha couldn't teach everybody. And teaching of gods and humans, even teaching of gods as well. Because sometimes people feel that, oh, you can only gain stages of enlightenment as a human being. What if you go into a heavenly realm? Can they become enlightened? The answer is yes. Because there was this story of these two monks. And I think the two monks, they came to a place for the rains retreat. And it was a very amazing woman, I think it was Sopaka her name was. And she looked after them for 2 months. She said, monks, you just meditate. I will cook for you and I will even wash your robes for you. Because I want you to have 100% opportunity, you know, to get enlightened. And so she did that and those monks. And they, well, must have meditated a little bit, but not much. They were slack, slept, weren't really good monks. So when they died, they were born in the Tara Tingsa realm, these two monks. And this Sopaka, she was born one level up in the Tusita realm. And when she found out that these two monks were actually reborn, not enlightened, they're even reborn in a plane lower than her. So she went to scold them. I cooked and cleaned for you. I looked after you. And what were you doing? I don't know what you're up to, but even what I was doing, I never had much time to meditate, but I was cleaning and looking after you, and I've been reborn in a higher realm than you, you scallywags. She didn't actually say that, but that's the sort of thing. And one of the reasons I repeat that is because one of those monks, they felt a bit of shame and aroused sati. And as a result of that, got reborn, I think, in the once returner realm. He actually got a promotion as an anagami, non-returner. And the other one was just so stubborn, now I'm not listening to that woman. And so I've just stayed where he was. But the interesting part was the use of the word sati. Sati, it doesn't always just mean mindfulness. It means recollecting. Recollecting all those teachings he had heard. And just putting them into practice very quickly as a deva, heavenly being, and actually getting a breakthrough into being a non-returner. An interesting use of the word sati, because sati actually also comes from the Sanskrit word smriti, which is like tradition. It's one of the reasons why that the Buddha sometimes says one with a lot of sati has a very good memory. They remember things long past. In other words, those are two words, mindfulness and recollection sometimes just overlap. Anyway, so Buddha arrives in the world, and with his own direct knowledge, he has realized this multi-universe. And I like that translation. In this universe with its God, its Mars, its humans, and so on. That doesn't really say very much, but this multi-universe does. With its gods, this world, with all its beings, he makes it known to others. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. With the right meaning, a right phrasing, he reveals a perfectly complete and pure spiritual life. So Buddha's arise in the world. Confidence. And you hear that Dhamma. On hearing that Dhamma, you acquire, you know, the Dhamma which is taught by Buddha. On hearing that Dhamma, you acquire faith in the Buddha. So even the Buddha may have passed away, still that Dhamma is very much alive. That was that phrase, the one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. So if ever you come across some of these evangelicals who say, well, our Christ is alive, he's risen, your Buddha is dead. You say, Nola, Singapore. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. The Dhamma is alive, so is the Buddha. It's true. So the Buddha is alive in the sense the Dhamma is still very strong in this world. So in hearing that Dhamma, acquire faith in the Buddha, possessing that faith, you consider thus, household life is troublesome and busy, life as a monastic, or even just putting a lot of time in your spiritual life is free and relaxed. It is not easy while living in a house to lead a holy life, utterly perfect and pure. Suppose I go off to Jhana Grove Retreat Center and go forth from the world of life into retreat for a few weeks. Now I just amended that translation a little to fit the context. On a later occasion, having given away all your iPads and turned off your mobile phone, you come to Jhana Grove and go forth from the home life into a retreat center for a certain time. Got to make it sometimes, adapt it to the local situation. When you have gone forth, you train in the monastic way of life, which you're actually doing here. You abstain from killing living beings. With rod and weapon laid aside, conscientious, mercifully, you live compassionate to all living beings. And I think somebody said they saw one of the blue-tailed lizards around. It's all little creepy crawlies, and they're really safe. And those little blue-tailed lizards, they come out when it starts to get warm, and they just want a bit of water. And I was saying, even the school kids, they know the blue-tailed lizards are safe. You just take them by the neck, and they'll put their mouth out. Ah! It's just a way of just saying hello. Well, actually, it's just a way of showing they're a bit scared, but they're safe. And so, no, nothing wrong with them. Even just when I was in Thailand, the snakes, even Thailand, now, they were venomous. In other words, if they bit you, you were in trouble. They never would bite you. And sometimes they'd crawl over you. I remember this one time in Thailand. Oh, what's a nice, it's one of the stories of snakes. One time, sitting meditation all night. Now, we used to do that once a week in Thailand. And after sitting meditation all night, you went to, you know, to relieve your bladder. And this was in the jungle, so you didn't go to the, you know, one of the fancy toilets. You just squatted down, Asian style, in the forest, just to urinate. And, number one, it's first thing in the morning, I've been meditating all night, so you're a little bit sort of tired. Number two, it was dawn, so the light wasn't very strong. And as I squatted down to urinate, that I really thought in the forest I was urinating on a stick.
But then the stick started to move. I was peeing on a snake. And as I mentioned to people, the males here will appreciate this more, the most vulnerable part of my anatomy was the closest part to the snake's mouth. But did that snake bite me? Of course not. Because this was in a monastery, it was in Thailand. That snake knew it was being blessed by holy water. And it was warm as well. Oh, he must have loved that. Such a lucky snake that day. They would never. And even sometimes in the hot season, you know, just after lunch, you stretched out and just had just my sarong on, the sabong, the lower robe, but bare-chested. And the tarantulas would drop from the rafters. And they just... They run up. And I really enjoyed that. It was like sensuous and tickly. And so, real trans, the big ones. But they were fine, so don't be afraid of these things. So you abstain from killing living beings with rod, weapon laid aside. Conscientious, mercifully, you live compassionate to all living beings, and living beings live compassionate to you. You abstain from taking what is not given. Taking only what is given, wanting only what is given, by not stealing, you abide in purity. You abstain in a monastery or in a retreat center from all sexual activity, living apart from others. You abstain from the lay practice of sexual intercourse. You abstain from forced speech. You only speak only the truth. Words that are trustworthy and reliable, you are no deceiver of the world. So when people talk to you and you say something, you can trust them. And, you know, sometimes in the world, finding somebody you can trust. You know, what they say is what they believe. Sometimes they may get it wrong because they misunderstand things, but at least they don't deceive anybody on purpose. You abstain from divisive speech. You don't not tell tales in order to divide people. Have you heard about what they said over there in the nuns' monastery? You don't say things like that to divide people. You are one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, who enjoys harmony, rejoices in harmony, delights in harmony, a speaker of words that promote harmony. You abstain from harsh speech. You speak only words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, that go to the heart, are courteous, desired by the many, and agreeable to the many. And if you've got to tell somebody off because they're misbehaving, you don't need to shout at them and scold them. Instead, you just take them aside and you say if you carry on like that, coming late to work every day, you know, the company's going to go broke. So, you know, you have to start coming earlier or, you know, we'll have to find you another place. If you can't come that early, then maybe we can get you, because you're busy in the morning sending your kids to work, maybe you can come as the night watchman. Now you try and find different employment for people. But you know that some people are so lazy. There's this short story I read a long time ago about this young man. And he was quite intelligent, but really, really lazy, and just so a sense of entitlement. And so when they tried to find him a job, they found that one of their friends owned a restaurant, so they got him a job as a waiter at a restaurant. You know, he can get lots of tips. And he had to give that up after half a day's work. He said, "Why are you giving it up?" He said, "Well, look, I see all this food and I'm always giving it to other people and I can't eat any of it myself. I'm hungry every morning. So I can't stand it any longer." So he said, "Okay. We'll give you a job as a cashier in that restaurant. So there's a screen there, so you won't see any of the food." And he gave that up after half a day. "I have to count all this money and none of it's mine." And he said, "This is a really hard person to get some work, because he was so lazy." And so they got him a perfect job as the
the guard at a cemetery. You won't see any food, you won't see any money. All you have to do is sit there in a little box at the gate of the cemetery to make sure that nothing goes wrong in there. And he had to give that up after half a day. What's wrong now? And he said, well, I spent all morning see all these people sleeping and laying down, and all I can do is sit up. Some people you can't give a job to. Anyway, the people lay down, the corpses. Anyway, where am I going? So you're staying from useless. Staying from useless speech. You speak at the proper time, speak what is truthful, speak on what is beneficial, speak on the Dharma and the training. At the proper time, you speak words that are worth treasuring, authoritative, succinct, and beneficial. And so sometimes people say, well, Champan, why didn't you keep that rule? What do I do? But you tell jokes. That's not the Dhamma, but it's beneficial. Because sometimes when you're giving a talk, you see people starting to look down at what the time is. Or they start, you know, not here but other places, they start just getting on their iPhones and seeing what messages have come in. And you know you're losing them. So that's when you tell a joke. And people sometimes, you know what it's like, sometimes they don't want... You know, they want to hear the Dharma sort of, but when it comes to joke, well, they can't miss that. And as this Tibetan monk once said, he said, the reason why he makes people laugh when he gives a talk is that when they laugh, they got their mouths open, and that's when he can throw in the pill of Dharma. Which is a nice little metaphor. So that's why it becomes useful speech. And you abstain from injuring seeds and plants, eating only in the morning, abstain from eating at night and outside the proper time, abstain from dancing, singing, music and movies. There was this occasion, a fundraiser we were doing once, I think it was for the Nuns' Monastery, and this is Dharamsala, when we started building that years ago. And this wealthy lady, she had a $10,000 check. She said, I will donate this to Dharamsala Nuns' Monastery if you will sing a song. And I thought, that's a difficult one because you're not supposed to sing songs. It says you'll stay from dancing, singing, music and movies. So I said to her, I thought very quickly, and said, can I choose a song? She said, yeah, any song. I said, okay, give me the $10,000 check first. It's made out, it's not to me, it's the Dharamsala Nuns' Monastery, so I can do it. And then I chose the song. Simon and Garfunkel, Sound of Silence. And for the next 3 minutes, I never said a word. That's my version of Sound of Silence. Though sometimes it's very difficult to outwit a monk. But anyway, she was very happy. She wanted to give it anyway. She was just trying to tease me and see to test me out. You abstain from wearing adornments, fragrances and cosmetics. You abstain from using luxurious furnishings. When it says high and luxurious furnishings, people say this is a retreat center. Aren't you supposed to sleep on the floor when you go on retreats? You've got your own beds with nice mattresses on there. Is that luxurious? Is that breaking those precepts? And of course it's not. The high and luxurious beds, Uchasayana and Mahasayana, doesn't mean you have to sleep on the floor. Doesn't mean you have to sleep on hard concrete, having scattered broken glass under there, first of all. What it means is like, not luxurious, just ordinary, enough so you can get a good night's sleep. And, otherwise, sometimes I thought, my goodness, I can't sit on high seats. You know the highest seat I've ever sat on? Is at 36,000 foot on Singapore Airlines going to see. That's a pretty high seat. But no, it doesn't mean that at all. It just means luxurious. In other words, we try and keep it simple. You abstain from accepting money. Oh, now that's a very good one because even 8 preceptors are not supposed to receive any gold, silver, or money. And that's one of the rules which really destroys monks and nuns.
And there's even 8 precepts.
This is not supposed to use luxurious... you've got a point there. You are right, again. 10 preceptors. And novices. And a garret. No, so 10 preceptors, novices, and monks. And nuns. Because once you have the ability to buy things yourself, you buy anything. And the doors of the cravings are just open for you. So that's one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah was really strict on that. And thank goodness, and so am I. So at the end of this retreat, and if any of you, if you don't know how we work, if you want to sort of say, oh, wonderful Ajahn Brahm, thank you so much, don't give me an ang pao full of cash. You know, give it to the donation box or to whatever project we're doing, but to a monastery, to a temple, but not to the monk. Because if you do, you're actually corrupting and destroying the monks and destroying the nuns. So, and I've lived very well without any money for how many years now? 45 years as a monk. And we say, oh no, but you've got to be practical. You know, sometimes, you know, you may go to the airport and there's no one there to pick you up. What do you do if you haven't got money? You walk. And people have tried that. You know, some monks have arrived at airports, even Perth Airport. And I said, when you arrive, we'll pick you up. I said, no. I'm going to just try, see what happens. And they arrive at Perth Airport. We don't know when they're coming. But they arrive there and they start walking out of the airport. They usually get about 100 metres and somebody stops and picks them up and gives them a lift all the way to Bodhinyana Monastery. Something is weird when you're a good monk, a good nun, a good person. There's always someone who will come and help you. It's always happened. So sometimes, do you really need money? As a monk? As a nun? People see you and they recognize that. And they'll always be there to help. I've never needed anything. And you accept from accepting raw grain and raw meat, in other words, storing things up. You abstain from accepting servants and slaves, accepting livestock, fields and lands, going on errands, running messages, buying and selling, practicing fraud, accepting bribes, deceiving, defrauding and trickery, from wounding, murdering, imprisoning, extortion, plunder and violence. Why on earth would a monk be doing things like that? Or a nun? But sometimes it does. Even gambling. There was this monk in Thailand. And he started off with really good intentions. Because his monastery needed some money to do some renovations. And he liked watching the EPL football. The Premier League football on TV. Where you can actually do gambling. So he thought, he's just borrowing the money from the donation box. And gambling again. He'll pay it back with interest because he was using his powers. But his powers were not that good. So he kept losing the money. And apparently, I saw this in the newspapers, he disappeared, he scarpered, because he was so bad at predicting the football results that he had no money left. And so, don't go gambling, because you always end up losing and stuff. But the problem is sometimes people expect monks to have psychic powers. Sometimes they say, come on, Ajahn Brahm, you know the lottery numbers. Come on, I really need it. And I'm desperate, I'm in big trouble, and I'll give you 10%. I say, I do all the work, and you only get 10%. And so do stuff like that. But there was this temple over in the Himalayas. And this temple in the Himalayas, the old monk was a really good monk. Not the temple with the doors. This is another temple. And this monk was such a good monk, the old abbot. And he knew, you know, whether it was going to be warm or cold, whether a storm was coming. He had that sort of, you know, that special sense. So one day, when he died, they had to get the new abbot. And the new abbot had big sandals to fill. You know, so when it came to the winter time, they asked the new abbot, as they'd always asked the old abbot, is it going to be a cold winter up here in the Himalayas? And he said, well, I'm not quite sure yet. Let me meditate tonight and I'll tell you in the morning. And while he's meditating at night, he's only new to the job as an abbot. His meditation wasn't that good. So instead, he got out his iPhone in the middle of the night and he rang up the weather bureau. And he got to the boss, the professor. He said, what's the weather, long-term weather forecast in the Himalayas? And the professor said, well, you know, no one knows yet. It's a bit early, but, you know, it'll probably be cold. So, in the morning, after the breakfast, the abbot said, I predict the weather will be cold this year in the Himalayas. So you better go and collect some wood. So the monks went out collecting wood. And after this week collecting wood, they said, this is enough. He said, I will meditate tonight and I will let you know. How many of you heard this story before? Oh, not that many. So I'll carry on. So that night, he rang up the professor again. And he didn't tell who he was. He said, how's the forecast going for the Himalayas? And he said, well, actually, the signs have become worse. It's probably going to be a very cold winter. So in the morning, the abbot told the monks, last night I saw the signs. It's going to be a very cold winter, so I'd better another week collecting wood. So they collected another week collecting wood. All over the monastery, every spare place was full of wood. Is it enough yet? Said the monks, tired. And the abbot said, I will let you know after tonight. And that night, they all said he was meditating, but he called the professor a third time. And he called the professor and said, how's it going? He said, well, the signs are so bad that it's going to be an extremely cold winter. Probably one of the coldest winters ever. Oh, thank you. Oh, by the way, how do you know? Oh, because all the monks in that monastery have been collecting wood like no one's business. That's lucky powers for you. We also said that's how Wall Street works. Ah, that's it. You've had a loophole. Yes, it's not in the list. Not taking alcohol or drugs. It's not actually in that list. But, and people have actually noted that before, but it's in other lists. So it's missed in this one. And of course, the drugs. It's usually like non-medicinal drugs. In other words, it's fine to take like morphine, which is an opioid, you know, or sometimes even these days, that medicinal marijuana, because apparently it does really help in many areas. So, if it's prescribed by the doctor, it's got a reason, not just recreation, not just to give you a high, then there's no problem there at all. And even alcohol. There was these four monks I knew, and actually some of them became quite well known. They were Westerners, and they received a Christmas gift from their mother, and they shared it with their friends. Wine gums. And they thought wine gums are just sweets. But these actual wine gums had real wine in them. And because the monks hadn't had any alcohol at all for years, even the tiny amount of alcohol in wine gums, that they were singing and very jolly. So you've got to be, if you haven't had alcohol for a long time, you've got to be very sensitive there, so be careful. Anyway, you become content with patch robes to protect your body and with arms food to maintain your stomach, and wherever you go, you travel taking only these with you, just like a bird wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden. So too you become content with patch roads to protect this body and with arms food to maintain your stomach. Wherever you go, you travel taking only this with you. And that's, you know, you try your very best. Wherever I go, you've, you know, receive me at Singapore. Sometimes you receive me at Indonesia on the airport there. You see, I've just only got my bag. Oh, it's not here. My little yarn. And that's all I take him when you go to UK. And sometimes when you go through customs, they say, have you got all your baggage, sir? I say, dear, this is it. Can you please explain why this is it? Why don't you carry suitcases? And I say, because I'm a monk and a few possessions. And when you say that, they get it. Say, oh, well done. Please go through. Because it's really rare, actually, to see people actually living that holy life with few possessions. And they respect it, even though they're not Buddhists. And so when you see people with huge suitcases, you know, and they're part of some religious order, going from place to place, you see, now where's the simplicity? Even Jesus said that you just take your sandals, you don't take any luggage with you. So it's wonderful to see how simple you can be. You only need just a change of clothes, that's all. And it's nice actually having just brown robes because there's no fashion. You don't have to change for evening wear and morning wear. And when you follow this noble virtue and contentment, you experience within yourself this delightful bliss, the joy of being blameless. When you think of your actions, they might be 100% perfect, but they're pretty good. And so you feel that you're inspiring yourself and you're inspiring others, leading by simplicity. Restraint of the senses. When you see an object, you do not let yourself get sucked in by its marks and features that generate defilements, since if you left the faculty of sight unguarded, unskillful states of wanting and aversion, the first of the five hindrances would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom when seeing. You guard the faculty of sight and you undertake the restraint of sight. Having heard a sound, smell, taste, bodily feeling, cognize something with the mind, you do not let yourself get sucked in by marks and features that generate defilements. Since if you left the mind faculty unguarded, unskillful states of wanting and aversion would afflict you. Instead, you practice wisdom with the mind. You guard the mind and undertake the restraint of the mind. When you follow this noble restraint of the senses, you experience within yourself an even more delightful bliss, the bliss of being unagitated. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to read this today, because you see, in this gradual training, you've got your faith, you've got your keeping your precepts, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Contentment is added there, simplicity, restraint of the senses. And the next part is clear comprehension, mindfulness. Here, you can see that now we're going into what's equivalent to the Satipatthana. And before, the restraint was almost exactly the same as the first of the so-called right efforts, Samavayama. So if you compare the gradual training to the Eightfold Path, this is the effort part, to restrain the senses. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to change it, to keep it in line with the gradual training, to change the translation of Samavayama to restraint. Yeah. Quite likely. Yeah, should be. That's the first of the five hindrances. The first means the first two, the first part. The first part of the retreat is not one day, but many days. Phew, I just escaped from that. I thought I made another mistake. So you act in the full comprehension of the purpose. Why are you doing things that you do? When going forward and returning, you act in full comprehension. The purpose, when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing and extending your limbs, when wearing your clothes and carrying things, you act in full comprehension of the purpose regarding eating, drinking, defecating and urinating, walking, standing, sitting, sleeping, being awake, talking, keeping silent. Why are you talking? It's one of the reasons why noble silence on these retreats doesn't mean keeping absolutely quiet. Because sometimes people think noble silence means no talking at all. So what happens if you see a snake? You want to warn someone. Show you, you can't speak to them. And they think you're crazy, and by the time they figure out what you're talking about, the snake's already bitten you. So that you keep quiet, unless there's a purpose to speaking. If there's a purpose to speaking, that, oh, you know, there's a piece of some oil over there, be careful, because you might slip. And if there's a purpose to it, then fine. We don't just talk just to waste time. We talk when there's a purpose. And that is the real right speech. That is a noble silence. If you can improve upon the silence, then speak. If you can't improve upon the silence, then be quiet. That is noble silence. And meditation, when you have developed this noble virtue, this noble restraint of the sense faculties, and this noble clear comprehension, you go to a secluded dwelling place, I have the full list here, such as the forest, the foot of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, or even a heap of straw. You sit down, you've heard this before, you sit down comfortably and establish mindfulness as a priority, abandoning wanting for the world of the five senses, such as loke abhija. You abide with the mind free from wanting. You purify the mind from desire. Abandoning aversion, you abide with the mind free from ill will, compassion for the welfare of all living beings. You thus purify the mind from aversion. People often don't complete that factor because they don't realize that compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, that you are one of those living beings. Sometimes people interpret that to be compassionate for the well-being of all other living beings, excluding me. So you are involved in this. So with aversion, be careful that you include you in compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. And don't be averse to yourself. Otherwise you think, stupid monk, come on. I don't deserve to be happy. You're compassionate to your welfare. There's aversion to you. Which is one of the reasons it's a hindrance. It stops you achieving deep meditation. Lack of self-worth. Aversion to you. So you're one of those living beings. So you, where's it gone? Abandoning aversion, you abide with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings, including yourself. You thus purify the mind from aversion. Abandoning dullness and drowsiness, you abide with a mind free from dullness and drowsiness, bright-minded, clearly comprehending, you purify the mind from dullness and drowsiness. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, you abide unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful, you purify the mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, you abide having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states, you purify the mind from doubt. I know that sometimes people before have gone to different traditions and sometimes they've seen a light in the mind. And, you know, they go to the teacher, no, you get attached, leave that alone, go back to the breath or go back to rise and fall or whatever. But you know sometimes that this is good, this is pure. And so trust in that intuition. And don't be perplexed. That is wholesome. That is peaceful. That is beautiful. The jhanas. And here, having abandoned the five hindrances, totally free from the five senses, free from unwholesome states, you enter upon and abide in the first jhana. And I went through this yesterday, so I'm just going to sail through this. The second jhana, the third jhana, and the fourth jhana. And that is the end of the gradual training. But you might ask, well, is that it? This is the training by the Eightfold Path stops at jhana. But what about the insight? And it was when I first started looking at the suttas in Pali, there is the collection of suttas called the Anguttara Nikaya, which sorts all the suttas from the ones to the twos, the threes, fours, fives and eights. And I thought, my goodness, where is the Eightfold Path? I could find the Eightfold Path nowhere in the group of eights. But later, as I read through further, you find it's in the tens. Why was that? Because, and now, if you can go down a little bit further to the tens, we've got the Eightfold Path right at the very end. Where has it gone? Okay, the wrong and right path. Have you got that? It's the wrong and right path. And the Anguttara sections, where you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. A bit further, yeah. A bit further down, yeah. Keep on going. Keep on going. Now, so I think it mixes it. Now a bit further. Here we go, wrong and right path. Here we go. So this is the first time when I saw in the Anguttara the Eightfold Path. But with the two extra factors. Because a path is a path, and the last two factors are the destination. So it says here, meditators, independent upon the wrong path, there is failure, not success. For one of wrong view, wrong motivation originates. For wrong of wrong motivation, wrong speech. Wrong speech leads to wrong action. Wrong action, wrong livelihood. Wrong livelihood, wrong restraint. Wrong restraint, wrong mindfulness. Wrong mindfulness, wrong stillness. Wrong stillness, wrong knowledge. And wrong liberation. On the other one, the Eightfold Path, plus the two results. Right view leads to right motivation. Right motivation to right speech. Right speech to right action. Right action to right livelihood. Right livelihood to right restraint. Right restraint, right mindfulness. Right mindfulness to stillness. Right stillness to right knowledge. And right knowledge to right liberation. Oops. It's amazing how often Mara comes in here and messes out this machine. Okay, where did that one go? Oops. Anyway, I think you can... Okay. Okay. It's not me that presses the wrong part of the screen. It's Mara. I always find someone to blame. Of course, that's not the right thing to do. So, where's the camera on? Where are you gone? Oh, no. Okay. So, you got that little... Hey, you didn't put it in there. Oh, I have to actually get that. Have you in there? You've got the list? Right for you. It's not in my one. It's just fallen out there. Yeah, no. Because... This was edited and stuff, so you've got the full one there. I haven't got this one. But as you can just should see the... you haven't got the arrows.
Oh, the arrows.
Yeah. Oh, there we go. No, not that one. For the Eightfold Path. No, okay. It's not in there. Okay, no. So it is actually that Eightfold Path is sequential. And in particular, that once there is the right stillness, it's then there is through seeing things they truly are, there is the knowledge and liberation. Oh, I keep losing it. So from right stillness, you get the right knowledge, seeing things as they truly are. And from that, the right liberation, freedom, enlightenment. So that gradual training in the Eightfold Path leads to those last two things. Okay, so... Okay, I think that's enough. I'll leave the other ones to tomorrow, Friday, in the afternoon, that it's the first Friday night after the end of the range retreat, even though the Katina ceremony is tomorrow, is on Sunday, that because after the Katina ceremony, I'm off to UK to help Venerable Chanda with the Anukampa project. But because of that, that I've got my name down for the Friday night talk. So the questions and answers tonight I will answer, but for the tomorrow after the morning session, which I will give, and the interviews, which I will give, and the after lunch, the interviews at 3 o'clock, but at 4 p.m. tomorrow afternoon, we have a special guest appearance on the Sutta Class show, which will be Ajahn Brahmani. And after 5 o'clock, he will come back at 7 or something for the 8 o'clock Q&A. That's not, yes, it's tomorrow night, Friday night. And on Saturday morning, I'll be back. After giving the talk at Nolamaro, I'll come back, sleep here overnight. So I'll be here for the chanting at some time. I don't have to worry because I just sit here and then the light comes on for me. So I'm just trusting that you'll shine the light on me, enlighten me for the time for the chanting. And then on the Saturday morning, then we'll have another talk and then whatever the ceremonies are. I think it's on the list in there. So just to let you know that tomorrow the Sutta class will be by Ajahn Brahmani. Okay. I don't think there's as many jokes. We shall see. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Hee hee hee. Very good. Ho ho ho. Any other announcements?
Some requested whether you could do the metta after the Dhamma talk on Saturday.
Can do. It means there'll be less chance for interviews. But you know, sometimes the interviews on Saturday morning, sometimes we don't have those interviews because if you haven't answered your questions now, probably a bit late. Saturday, okay, yeah. Is that okay with people? Of course, if you just got enlightened and you want it confirmed, then you can come and say, ah, not you, and check you out. Or you can have it confirmed at lunch. We'll mix all of the food together. So anyway, so okay, we do the metta meditation. If we have time, we may have about time for 2 or 3 interviews or something, but we won't have a list. So see who comes. Well, actually, I did ask people that those are people who can guess what my nickname was when I was a school teacher, get a special interview. So see if you can find that out. There are a few people, ask Ajahn Brahmani, you would say.